Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Friday, November 4th, 2011. I'm your host, Greg Luca, and I'm very excited today to be coming to you on location from Tyler's bedroom where all the magic happens. I can only imagine the kind of dirty, lewd things that have gone on in here.
I prefer not to imagine.
Naturally joining us is Tyler Jett, who can break down some of the stuff that's been going on in this room lately.
I'm not going to break down all the stuff that's been going on in this room lately.
That's what the listeners want, man.
Well, we can tell you what the room looks like. It's a nice light tan paint job on there. We've got some posters. The Shawshank Redemption poster.
The number one that stood out to me is Denarius Moore. I like that.
I'm confused.
The Denarius Moore poster. That's the little thing that we gave out when we went to Tennessee last year.
And you just happened to save it, and then he was good, or you put it up right away?
I just put it up right away. I thought it was pretty cool.
Huh, that worked out pretty well for you.
FC Barcelona scarf. That's a little thing for you soccer fans. Makes all the ladies know I'm cultured. I've got a Muhammad Ali poster to let people know that I am diverse.
And what about that?
And then to cap it off, I've got a nice photo of Snoop Dogg and Tupac wearing suits.
I wouldn't say that caps it off, per se.
I'm pretty sure it's Pop Saunders on the right.
Saunders.
That's Tupac.
Before we get any farther, Cody Jones is here from FightingGators.com and Florida.Scout.com. We could say what's up or something.
Hey, what's going on? You probably should introduce me before I drop that line, but that's fine.
No, it's all good. I mean, people know who you are. We would like if there were some first-time listeners, but at this point, we're probably not attracting any new customers, so let's see what we got. One of my favorite features of the room is the Richard Sowatch poster. You might have to talk that through for people.
Yeah, if you're not Richard Sowatch listening to this podcast, you probably don't know who Richard Sowatch is.
I bet he does.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah. Well, let me explain. Let me learn you something, Cody. Richard Sowatch is a pawn shop owner in Gainesville, but he also is very involved in the politics. The scene in Gainesville. He has run for a lot of different offices. He ran for mayor at one point, unsuccessfully. Last year, he ran for city commission, and I might have broken a law, but I do have one of his Richard Sowatch for city commission campaign posters, or what would you call these, signs, I guess?
Yeah, it's a little sign.
Yeah, it's one of those things you see on the side of the road. I've also got a nice photo from the Independent Florida Alligator of him at one of the debates.
Just bugging out.
Just going insane.
Yikes.
It's when he introduced himself as Diamond Rick the Pawnbroker. That was his alter ego for the election.
Yeah, like, I mean, I think that's an important note that kind of tells you a little bit about him, is that he is a pawn shop owner, and that's just his occupation, right? That's just what he does. So.
That's what he does, but that's on the side.
Yeah,
really,
aside from, like,
he's a political
politician,
activist.
Yeah.
So how did you get connected with him?
What do you mean connected?
Everybody's connected with him in some way.
One time, me and former Alligator sports editor Adam Berry went to his pawn shop looking for a boombox.
On purpose, or you just stumbled on his pawn shop?
No, we went to every pawn shop in Gainesville just to get the local culture.
Wow.
And nothing says Gainesville like a bunch of pawn shops.
And you survived, too.
Yeah. We ran into some drug dealers, I'm pretty sure. It was right when we were both watching The Wire, so we kind of understood what was really going on in these pawn shops.
Right.
But... yeah, Richard was a man of the people, man. He was holding it down in his pawn shop. Somebody came in because he bought a PlayStation 3, but he couldn't find the controllers. And Richard said, "I wouldn't cheat you, man. Those controllers were in there. Just keep looking at your house. You'll find the controller."
Just keep looking in your house.
I don't know how that ever played out, but the point is, he is a politician to the end. He's got a great heart. He really loves the people.
Great heart.
Yeah, that's how we ended up meeting Richard Sowatch, Diamond Rick the Pawnbroker. That's how we came in with him.
As a student in reporting last year, I had to sit through one or two of these city commission meetings and pretend I cared. And he made it interesting because he's quite the character. Did you get to talk to him personally? Do you know him now? Are you guys boys?
Not really. I mean, the extent of our conversation was, well, before now he's obviously listening to this and he's going to give us a shout out. But the extent of the relationship between Diamond Rick and I really is just, hey, do you have a boombox? And him being very sweaty because there's no AC in his pawn shop and it was very hot, and he said, "No, sorry, buddy, I don't have a boombox."
That's sad.
Conversation though.
If you're Richard Sowatch and you're listening to this and you want to respond, you can send feedback to podcast@alligator.org. Any other listeners can send feedback to podcast@alligator.org. We like to hear from all of you guys. Huge show today. We got all the football stuff, some bigger picture things, some Vanderbilt things, little hoops talk. We get into an email discussion at the end. There's a lot of stuff going on. Obviously, all the Gator guarantees and whatnot. So, I guess we're just going to get right into it. But yeah, like I said, feedback to podcast@alligator.org. We love to hear from you guys. All right, before we get into kind of the Vanderbilt game preview, I want to talk about some bigger picture stuff. Obviously, the Gators lost all four games in October, but they were four games against ranked teams, and I guess conceivably they could turn it around. So, it seems like a lot of people are kind of giving up on this team, but to you guys, is it a lost season or is it just disappointing at this point?
I would say a lost season.
I think that's fair.
Really?
I mean,
like, even if they, like, won out, it would just, it's already sucks.
Well, no. If they won out, then it wouldn't be a lost season. But the thing is, it's already a lost season, so they're not going to win out. Like, I see it as a chicken versus the egg thing.
Okay, well, I mean, what makes you say it's a lost season? It's just...
that they're 4-4. I mean, you just watch the team walk off the sidelines after games. They don't care anymore. Like, you fall apart at that point. Like, you come into the season, you have hopes, you have dreams, you want to win the SEC East, you want to go to Atlanta. That's so far out of the picture now. What are you really playing for?
Well, I guess there's nothing, like, concrete that you're playing for, but, like... most teams aren't playing for anything under that kind of logic. Like, outside of the top 10, nobody really has anything, because there's,
well, teams, every team comes in with a certain, like, plan for their season. So, a team that's not that good, or a team that's kind of a lower-rung team, obviously isn't playing for conference championship necessarily, but they're playing to improve. They're playing to show that they are better than they were the year before, and that they can get the ball rolling, and then maybe at one point they will be a conference contender. Florida comes into the season expecting to compete for a conference championship. They came in as a top 25 team. People didn't think, all right, everyone kind of thought that was maybe a little bit too high of a ranking, or most people who have been covering the team thought that was too high of a ranking, but there was still this thought of, this is Florida, this team has talent, at some point, they can put it all together, maybe they become a dark horse candidate in the SEC.
Well,
yeah, I mean, I think that makes sense. The thing is, they can still, I think, turn this thing around and at least end with some positive parts of the season. If they beat Florida State, I think that's kind of the thing they're focused on. Is you get bowl eligible and you beat Florida State, and I think they would be just fine as far as maybe a perspective goes. Obviously, still, that'd be a six loss season, so it still wouldn't be a great season. But I think that would make things a little bit more positive for them. And I think in their eyes, their two goals just to become bowl eligible and to focus on that Florida State game.
Yeah, but that's pathetic.
Like, oh, sure, no, it's players, absolutely.
These players aren't coming in thinking, okay, maybe we can get bowl eligible. At this point, they don't care. Like, obviously, they want to get bowl eligible. You get, like, a free gift card to Best Buy if you're bowl eligible.
Absolutely.
And you get that extra month of practice, which is great for the coaching staff. But I think from a motivation standpoint, I can't see these guys being that motivated by that.
Right. No, I agree with you. I'm not justifying that at all. I'm saying there still is some way for them to come out positive out of the season, or at least go into the offseason a little bit positive.
I mean, I guess from a player motivation standpoint, I kind of agree with you, Tyler. But the thing that sticks out to me is, I mean, they lost three games against ranked teams. Nobody's beaten LSU and Alabama. They lost to Auburn on the road with a backup quarterback, and they lost to Georgia at a neutral site with only being able to throw the ball. So, I mean, when you look at it that way, it's really not as bad as it seems, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like you guys are kind of factoring that into your assessment of the season.
Well, that's pretty bad. That's 0-4 against only four good teams they've played this year.
Yeah, but you don't have your best player. Like that.
They don't care about that. They want to win the game.
I mean, they don't care about that, but in our evaluations, do we give them a little bit of a break for that?
Nope.
Okay. Cody, you either?
You figure out a way to win a game even if you don't have your best. He's your best player. He's a quarterback.
He's probably their most valuable player.
He's their most important player. I think Rainey is probably their best player, but their most important player is Brantley because of the fact that he's the quarterback. Having said that, though, you had a month. I mean, you had three games to figure that out, and you didn't figure it out.
It's not just 0-4, it's the way it looked. Like, it was so ugly. Every game, like, even the games that they got beat by the LSU and Alabama, like, teams have stayed in the game against those teams, and they couldn't even come close to really doing that at any point in the LSU game. And once the Alabama game, once Brantley came out, it got really ugly. And the Auburn and Georgia games were just so ugly on offense. And I understand that losing your quarterback obviously throws you back, but at some point, you know, there are freshman quarterbacks that are at least capable across the country and show signs of doing things, and then their offenses aren't completely irrelevant just because they're freshmen out there. Like, I feel like it was just – it's more of how this team looked than the actual losses.
Right,
and I would also say you got to figure they put all their eggs in those Alabama LSU games, you know what I mean, making a statement against the best teams in the nation, and they just got obliterated. And that you can't come back from that well.
I mean, I'll agree with you on the point that those games were not fun to watch, especially the Georgia and Auburn games are some of the worst games I've seen at any level of football in a while, but I still just feel like there's a way that they could win these last four games and turn it around and finish ranked, and that would be to some level of success if they're motivated enough to do that.
You think they can win these last four games?
I think it's possible. Like, I think there's like a 5 to 10% chance. Like, it's on the table.
I mean, I just don't know if I agree with that.
I'll say there's a 5 to 10% chance.
Yeah, there's a chance.
No one's banking on a 5 to 10% chance of the team going.
Well, yeah, that's why I'm not saying. But like, if there's,
what are you saying?
If it's a lost season, there's like a 0% chance they can do anything good.
I mean, there's always a little bit of a chance. It's sports; anything can happen. You know what I mean? Like, any team, any team, if they're motivated, something fluky.
Well, what I'm saying is, if they lose to Vanderbilt this weekend, then there's nothing else that can happen for it to not be a failed season. like there's a 0% chance they can lose to Vanderbilt and still consider it a decent year. But at this point, I think it's still on the table that if they win out, it would be a decent season. Agree? Can, disagree?
Can they win out? That's the thing. Like, I mean, I understand your point, and I think it could be a decent season because then it looks a lot better too because you go in the offseason with momentum and everything like that. You go to the bowl game and things look a lot better on paper.
Just like Tennessee went to the offseason with momentum right. last year.
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of the thing is the schedule. I mean, outside of South Carolina, Florida State looks better, but it's still kind of, I mean, they've been beaten up on the Dukes and the Boston Colleges of the ACC, so it's not really, you don't really know where they're at right now. And I just don't see any way they can win South Carolina regardless of who's playing running back for them.
Right. Okay, well, for you guys who think it's lost, do the last four games matter from, like, a recruiting perspective or a booster's perspective or Muschamp's job security perspective? What are we looking for?
Muschamp's job is secure. It's his first year.
Well, I mean, long-term, even. Like, if you start off, you know, 5-7, that doesn't really... If you have a rough year the next year, then you could be in trouble.
Well, yeah, if he loses his job after 3 years, I think, like, no matter what, he's getting 3 years. That's the logical thing to do when you're working with a football coach is you got to give him a couple of years to get his players in. That's how it has to be. But... Unless it's Turner Gill, he needs to go at Kansas. Just Garrett Turner Gill. But anyway,
little Kansas talk.
Yeah, stuck a little Kansas talk in there for all our listeners out in Lawrence. but yeah, I think he's gonna be fine. He's gonna have 3 years. I don't think this season is gonna play a part in ultimately deciding whether he keeps his job or not. The next two seasons are gonna play a much bigger part than that.
I agree with that. The thing is, whether fair or not, these four losses I think have fans and maybe even people above starting to think, you know, is he the right guy? And to be honest, I don't think that is fair. You've got to give him some time. But I think that does maybe get the ball rolling a little bit because it makes people think about it, whether or not it's a smart thing to do.
Outside of Muschamp's job security, from like a recruiting perspective, does it matter? Are kids going to look at it and say 5-7 team, I don't want to go to that school? Or
yeah, there's definitely going to be those kids. There should be somebody who's going to look at it the other way, though, and say we can play immediately. So I don't really know because I don't follow recruiting close enough to tell you, but you got to figure it's kind of going to be balancing out because there's going to be kids that are always going to want to play early, and there's going to be kids that always want to go to the best teams.
It's all how you spin it as a coaching staff, and they can find ways to do that, and it sounds like they are, but still, a four-game losing streak at a national program like Florida, there's no way you can say that that's going to help this program in the long run in terms of recruiting. So I think it certainly can open people's eyes to see immediate playing time and where they need help, but I don't think it's certainly not the ideal way to go about recruiting as a new coaching staff.
So it sounds like kind of going forward in terms of next year, you guys don't think for the future it's a big difference whether they finish this 8-4 or 5-7?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't really think so.
All right. Well, I guess one thing while we're kind of near the recruiting topic is that something Tyler wrote about this week in one of his columns is the concept of oversigning and why Florida doesn't do it. And I'm not very familiar with this, and I don't know how many of our listeners are, so why don't you just break down kind of what the policy is and what the national norm is on that
front. Okay, University of Florida policy, according to a spokesman that I talked to this week, is that over a four-year span, the team can't sign more than 85 players because the NCAA scholarship limit for a team is 85. That may seem logical to you, but few other teams are actually following that policy because they're planning on a lot of these players leaving early, whether it be for the draft, whether it be that they get kicked off, whether it be that they just accidentally don't qualify, whether it be that they're mad after 2 years not playing and they transfer. There's a lot of different reasons that players end up leaving early. I mean, you can see it at Florida, obviously. So these teams like Auburn and Alabama and LSU will sign well north of 100 players during that four-year span, knowing that they're going to lose a lot of guys, but it's going to still keep them around that 85 number. Now, Florida, last 4 years, signed 84 players. It adds up to 85 if you look at the last four signing classes, but that's only because T. Finley signed twice, because the first time he didn't academically qualify. Really good job signing that guy twice.
Yeah.
But anyway, T. Finley, along with a lot of other players at Florida, have left. I think it's around 25. I don't have the number exactly off my head. I think, it's 22, I think. At any rate, it ends up being that they only have about 61 or 62 players left on the team now that were originally offered scholarships out of high school or out of a junior college. So those are 62 players that Florida actually recruited. Look at these other teams, like Alabama, Auburn, LSU. They're in the 75 to 80 range for the most part. That's because they're signing way more people. Auburn, for example, is the biggest offender. The last 4 years, they've signed 112 guys, and 40-something guys have left early, prematurely. Now, from Florida's standpoint, what they're saying is it's almost a moral point. I don't remember if you guys know about the Bernie Matchin op-ed that he wrote to Sports Illustrated back beginning of this year, like the day before National Signing Day, kind of talking about how it was immoral to sign over and all these other things. And I agree with him that it is immoral, although I'm surprised that Florida is actually following that. However, you look at the numbers and it actually does add up. Now, how is that affecting Florida? Obviously, they've lost about 20-something guys. The other team lose about 20-something guys. The difference is Florida ends up with about 60 scholarship guys, but the rest of these guys end up with about 80-something guys.
So these other schools have people just sitting around waiting for early departures and stuff to get their scholarship? Or how does, like, if they don't have people leave and they end up having more than 85, some of those extra people are screwed, basically? Is that...
Yeah, well, scholarships right now are only one-year deals. So, like, let's say you had, going into a signing class, let's say you had about 20 spots open and you signed 28 guys, maybe. You're banking on maybe three or four guys from your team that's currently on the team transferring. Maybe one or two get kicked off, and then maybe you get one or two guys who end up, let's just say, going to the draft. You would, let's, now, after that, you say you end up with one or two guys that are still over the limit. Like, you would still end up at 87 at that point. Well, a couple of guys who aren't that good, you might just slide in them a medical hardship deal, which is basically saying, you weren't good enough to play for us, but we're going to let you keep going to school for free. Like, we'll keep giving you a scholarship. That's what that, you know about the medical hardship.
Yeah,
deal,
yeah.
Right? So that can be a situation. Sometimes it's legitimate. Sometimes a guy actually has an injury and they can't go anymore. And then you just give them this scholarship that says, you keep going to school for us, we'll keep paying for it, but it doesn't count against their scholarship limit. Other guys, however, just get this medical hardship deal because their game is so bad. And they're just like, well, you're never going to have a chance to play for us, so we're going to give you this medical hardship. You can keep going to school, but you're not going to count against our scholarship limit. At the end of the day, I don't know if that's a huge deal, but it does put you in some weird spots.
So, okay, so if Florida, here's what I don't get. If Florida, like, recruits 20 guys a year for 3 years, and then the last year they're going to get a class of 25 or whatever it is, but some of those other guys leave early, can't they then just recruit those extra spots up to 85, however many people left from the first couple classes?
I don't understand why they want to do that, but they told me this, their policy is 85 over a four-year span.
Okay. Like, and that's, is that something that's been at Florida for a while, like even when they were good, or is this kind of a new thing that they're doing?
Well, supposedly this has been there ever since Machen and Foley have been in power, basically. Like, when Urban was here, that was the same policy. The one thing I would say, though, is they've never really been tested on this. Like, what happens now? Like, now that this is seriously a problem for the team, like, we can all agree that the depth is an issue for this team. Do you keep this policy going forward, or, I mean, would you change it?
My question... Here, I'll let you... What do you think about that, Greg?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, because I think certainly we can see scenarios where it would be nice to have other guys, maybe just to push the guys they have now. I think it would be nice to have different starters instead of better depth, too, but...
Well, yeah, but that's part of the depth thing, is, like, you don't have anybody pushing you. Also, like, generally speaking, if you had... Like, they have, for example, look at offensive tackles. They have four offensive tackles. Xavier Nixon, Matt Patchen, Chaz Green, and Kyle Coney. Kyle Coney doesn't play offensive tackle, but he's listed as one of their four offensive tackles.
Yeah.
Chaz Green's been out with an ankle injury, so they've only got two. The thing is, the more you have, the better chances one of those guys is going to work out.
Do you think the idea of pushing, like, guys pushing other guys in practice is, like, a legitimate thing? Are you actually not trying that hard if the guy behind you isn't that good, or...?
I think it pushes you more, because everybody wants to play, and if you've got someone, you need that competition.
I think
that was... When you look back, I mean, have you ever... I don't know if you've ever watched that documentary on the University of Miami, but they always talk about how the best players that they went against were the guys that were playing in practice, and that depth just kind of pushed those guys to be better and better and better. That was the same thing people at Florida were talking about. I remember back in the 09 season, and then people were talking about, like, at the time, people thought Will Hill was a great safety. You had Ahmad Black. You had, who was the third safety?
Major Wright.
And Major Wright. Those, at the time, looked to be three really good safeties, so people were talking about, like, how much better Ahmad Black and Major Wright got, because they had to worry about Will Hill also being involved in the mix. You know what I mean? So I think that depth would definitely affect you positively.
And your biggest ally as a coach is the bench. I think the ability to throw somebody on the bench because you have better or at least comparable talent to throw out on the field, I think that really helps you out. And Muschamp just doesn't have that right now, because he'd be throwing walk-ons out there.
Look at the Georgia game where Chris Rainey, he fumbled the ball, Georgia goes in for a touchdown. People kind of look at that as a game-changing play. Rainey was in on the next drive.
Right.
And I think from what we've heard, it's kind of part of the penalty problem, too, because they can't necessarily bench guys for that or do, like, certain punishments in practice is what they're saying they haven't been doing. And Muschamp didn't directly say, we can't do this because we don't have a lot of guys, but it was in the same sentence. It was something like, we just don't have a lot of guys right now, so we're not really, like, doing anything about, you know, the, like, trying to get people off the field because of penalties and stuff like that. So, I mean, I guess that's a factor, too. How much of a difference would it really make, do you guys think, if they had an extra 15, 20 guys just back there kind of pushing people, how much better would this team be? Do you have? Can you kind of quantify that at all?
It's hard to quantify it on like a win-to-loss thing. Like, I just don't know. I think it's impossible to kind of know that. But I would say that the team overall would definitely be better. I don't know how much better. I would imagine like Xavier Nixon wouldn't be out there at left tackle, which is a big factor. Like, you get it's a bunch of little things. I think you add those little things up, and maybe that translates to one win, maybe even two wins, because both of those games have been pretty close.
So it's more, I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's more about having more kind of lottery tickets that could pan out into good players more than just having more bad guys behind the bad guys you already have.
Right. One other thing that I would bring up is the fact that, I mean, really, after John Brantley goes out, their next most veteran quarterback is in his second year, and then you got two freshmen. Generally speaking, you want one quarterback per signing class, so that if Brantley goes out, you have like a junior that can step in. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, they had to go really far down right after Brantley went down.
Right. Okay.
Michael, one question I had about the oversigning thing. Do you feel like there is coaching stability any part of this? Because you talk about like Alabama, Auburn, LSU, who've had like consistent head coaches for a while. The transition obviously has kicked some guys out with Muschamp. Do you feel like that's any part of it?
I think the transition like affects it a little bit, but I don't think it's that much. Like Auburn, Gene Chizik has been around for a couple of years.
Right.
Plus, I mean, the point is that like even Alabama and LSU, where they've had stable coaches, Les Miles has been at LSU for like 7 years. Saban's been in Alabama for five. You're right. It is five. Sorry. Yeah, so this is his fifth year there. And those places still have just as many. No, all of those places actually have lost more players prematurely than Florida has, even with a new coach at Florida, which would obviously make you think, okay, you're going to have a lot of players losing. So they've actually lost less players, despite the fact that they brought in a whole new coaching regime than these other programs did. So I don't necessarily think that that plays a factor in it. One thing I will say, though, is obviously with the SEC tightening up these rules going forward, I think they had this. They originally didn't really have a cap on it, and then like Ole Miss a couple years ago signed 37 players, and then it became this big deal. So the cap became like 28, but coaches were still violating that. And so now going forward, there's a hard cap at 25 for every other signing class going forward. So that could affect every team.
But that would still be 100 over 4 years and would be way over the limit. So they're still kind of allowing oversigning, right?
Yeah, they're allowing oversigning. Okay. But it's at least capped a little bit.
Okay. So, Cody, we were going to ask you this, but we never actually did. Do you think they need to change the policy sometime soon to, you know, kind of turn it around? How much would that help?
Does Florida need to change it?
Yeah.
I mean, if it's a moral issue, I don't think you can really argue with that. It's just kind of the way they feel about the situation. I think that this certainly has to have them thinking about it. That's the thing you look at. I mean, when you're getting beat on the field as bad as they are and having really no depth to work with, you've got to at least consider it. And if that's something they feel like is necessary. But if you're claiming it's a moral issue, though, then it's kind of hard to go back on that and say, okay, now we're going to allow it all the same.
Right. I think if the starters they had were better, we wouldn't be talking about it. But that doesn't mean it's not an issue. And I think just to level the playing field with every other school, you shouldn't be choosing to put yourself at a disadvantage necessarily. So
I also think it's a little bit naive to assume that you give guys 85 scholarships over 4 years, all those guys are going to stay there for all 4 years. You've got to know a lot of these guys are going to leave for multiple reasons.
Right.
It's not just a moral issue like that. I mean, it is kind of a common sense issue like that, too. And you're also, you put a lot more pressure on your ability to evaluate talent, too, because you can't whiff very much, as much as Alabama and LSU can on guys. You've got to be really good, and the guys you bring in have to be really good, and right now that's just not the case.
It's like a moral issue as much as it would be if they said it was a moral issue that they only recruit 22 players because they want everybody they bring in to start. Like,
exactly.
It just doesn't make sense to me from that perspective, really. And I get the whole, like, having people on scholarship thing, but what history, at least at Florida, has shown us is that they can make room for those guys because people are going to leave early, people are going to get, you know, kicked off the team for unfortunate reasons, and there's going to be transfers. So I think there's definitely room to bring in some extra recruits and make room for them as the seasons go along. All right, veering away from that and kind of focusing in on the Vanderbilt game, Tyler, you kind of had an interesting take. I think you're really excited for Saturday, right?
This is going to be the worst game I've ever covered.
And that's saying something after the last two.
It's just like going to be two bad teams just getting in a little cat fight.
When you first said this to me, I was kind of thinking there's no way it could be worse than Auburn and Georgia because both of those games were as bad as they can be on their own level. Like, Auburn was the most offensively inept game, and Georgia was just the most just bad play all around game.
Right. And the thing is that this game isn't like there's one average team and one really bad team playing. it's two average teams. They're sort of going to average each other out. Like, if it's Florida-Kentucky, that's kind of exciting because, you know, Florida's better athletes and they're going to put up 40 points. We can see some big plays. Like, it doesn't mean anything, of course, but at least it's something to watch. This is just two teams that are just down the middle of the road in the SEC East, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible division. Vanderbilt is sixth in scoring defense. Florida is seventh in scoring defense. These are just conference games. Scoring offense, Florida is seventh. Vanderbilt is ninth. Florida, okay, just look at that. Florida's averaging 21.3 points per game. Vanderbilt is averaging 17.8 points per game. There's nothing in this that looks good. There's no sort of matchup in this that you say, okay, Vanderbilt's really bad at this, and Florida's pretty good at this, so maybe they'll do pretty good.
Or the other way around, either, right?
What's that? Yeah. I mean, they're both sort of just very average, so you just can't really figure it out. The one thing is that Vanderbilt's pass defense is just atrocious, but I'm not having much faith in Florida's pass offense.
Right.
So I don't think they've got the ability to exploit that. Vanderbilt's got the worst pass defense in the conference. They're averaging they're giving up 258.6 yards per game on the back end. Of course, that's also after a game against Arkansas. But
they also lead the SEC in interceptions.
Yes, that's the one thing.
They're second now.
This is so confusing.
Yeah, no, they're second.
Oh, they're second?
Well, in conference games, they're second in interceptions with 10. That's impressive. So I think they just gamble a lot. I think that's what it is. They're just going to either get a pick or give up a 60-yard touchdown. So it's going to be just bad. There's not a whole lot I can really say. Vanderbilt can't kick field goals. They're 1-for-4 in conference games.
Just one for, okay.
They've kicked four field goals.
I wonder if that's what I'm more surprised by.
I wonder if they've just stopped trying.
Yeah, that's through five.
Maybe they just stopped trying because they can't kick field goals.
That's a good idea.
Perhaps.
And if we've learned anything, that's a really good idea against Florida.
This could be the most boring matchup. Vanderbilt's defensive line versus Florida's offensive line. Vanderbilt is 10th in sacks with 7, and Florida is 11th in pass protection, having allowed 17 sacks.
Florida's offensive line is definitely like number 12 in the SEC in overall goodness, right?
No, it's tied for 11th.
Just in overall ability?
Well, that just means that there's two teams that are just equally bad.
I can't believe there's another team that's bad.
Ole Miss. Houston Nutt says hi.
Maybe. I haven't seen Ole Miss. I don't know a whole lot about them.
Let's see. Vanderbilt is terrible at defending on third downs. They are the worst in the SEC.
But Florida can't move it on.
Yeah, but Florida is 10th in converting third downs. Florida converts third downs 26.3% of the time in conference games. Vanderbilt gives up first downs on third down 47% of the time. Neither one's good.
Wow. Something's got to give.
The grand poobah.
I can't believe there's more.
Yeah, here's a lot
more. This really sucks.
There's two more. Turnover margin, Vanderbilt is tied for 7th with a -3 turnover margin. Florida is tied for 10th with a -6 turnover margin. Nobody on defense wants the ball. Well, actually, that's not true. That's the thing. Vanderbilt gets all those interceptions, but they just don't want to hold on to the ball. So this is going to be disgusting. And here's really the kicker for me, is the fact that you get both of these teams, somehow they end up in the red zone, nothing's going to happen. Florida is...
they haven't scored a red zone touchdown since September.
Yeah. Well, they're actually okay as far as scoring, but they're not good at scoring touchdowns. They scored 4 touchdowns in 14 attempts in the red zone. That's Florida. Vanderbilt has scored 6 touchdowns in 11 attempts, which is good, but it's only 11 trips, and they've actually only scored 7 times because, again, they can't get good goals.
Right, they just don't have that ability.
Yes, that's probably why. They're probably just going for it on 4th down every time. And, I mean, just...
That could actually be important.
Yeah.
I don't know. It could be a close game. If you can't kick a field goal, that might matter.
We learned that last year.
Yeah, we learned that last year in the Mississippi State game. A couple of the studs for Vanderbilt. Zach Stacy has actually looked pretty good, so I'm not going to bash him. He's fifth in the conference in rushing, averaging 83.2 yards per game. He had a good run against Arkansas. I don't know if you guys saw that or not. It was like a 50-something yard touchdown run. So here's to you, Zach Stacy. But they've also got a little quarterback named Jordan Rodgers, brother of Aaron Rodgers.
Oh, yeah, Aaron Rodgers.
I think Aaron Rodgers like ate all his food as a kid or just took all of his talent. Jordan Rodgers is not a talented quarterback. He is averaging passing average yards per game. He is 7th in the SEC with 84.6 yards per game.
How is that 7th?
Because there's Matt Sims, Derek Trotter, and Clint Mosley.
The quarterbacks in the SEC are just terrible.
It really is like a dreadful year for SEC quarterbacks.
Yeah, I know Wilson's first with 248 yards.
Yeah.
I know it goes in cycles, but I mean, just coming off like Tebow, Newton, Mallett, I mean, all these guys that were, like, really good college quarterbacks to just nothing right now.
Right. Aaron Murray is second in the conference with 233 passing yards.
And he didn't look that good.
No. He completed, like, he didn't complete 50% of his passes.
No, yeah, he struggled.
Like, back in 07, 08, I feel like Tyler Wilson would have been, like, maybe the 7th or 8th best quarterback in the SEC. And now he's like, the best.
Yep. It's just, I guess it goes in cycles, but it's just crazy that the best football conference in America can't find, like, 12 average guys.
Well, I mean, also, you got to figure that the SEC's strength is defense.
Yeah.
True, but a lot of these quarterbacks look bad.
Yeah. I don't know. It's weird, because you look a lot better if you're Case Keenum. You don't face the defense. You're just doing 7-on-7 drills against the air.
That's true.
You know what I mean? Like, Pac-10, nobody plays defense out there.
Yeah.
Big 12, nobody really plays defense out there. So, like, a lot of times those quarterbacks just look awesome because of the fact that there's not a whole lot of competition.
But they'd look better than this, though.
Right. 70 yards. I don't know. Case Keenum could throw for 80.
I'm not defending those guys, but I'm saying at the top end, like, I don't know if you put Brandon Weeden in the SEC. I don't know if he's averaging over 300 yards passing game. I think he might be averaging
probably not.
No, I agree with that.
So he might be on par with Tyler Wilson. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fair.
He's also almost 30, so.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's just a thing.
It's just a thing.
You just want to point that out, huh?
Yeah, I did.
Anyway.
Make you feel better about yourself.
Thanks, guys. That's why I'm here.
One thing that is kind of unique and interesting about such a crappy game is that this is the first time all season Florida's faced a mobile quarterback. Rodgers has rushed for 257 yards this year, which is like 30 a game, but he wasn't involved in the offense earlier in the season as much as he is now. So
well, that's the first time they faced a mobile quarterback of that effect since last week. So there's that.
Wait, who?
Aaron Murray?
He's not Jordan Rodgers running the football.
He's about, like, yeah, but look at his yards. It's not that much different.
Right, but I'm saying, like, Aaron Murray has played a lot in every game. He's been there.
Yards per game.
No, because that's what I'm saying. He's been involved in every game more heavily than Jordan Rodgers has. A lot of games, Jordan Rodgers is playing, like, 3 plays.
Okay.
But now he's, like, their guy.
He's
I think
the man.
Lately he's been doing a lot more, especially compared to Aaron Murray. But you don't think he's that, like, you don't think he's a better athlete or a faster player? Or
I honestly don't know.
A bigger threat to run?
I can't give you the answer on that. But I can't imagine he's going to be a more difficult quarterback to face than Aaron Murray.
Okay, well, if I told you that I think he's definitely a much better runner, is Florida equipped to face that? Do they have what it takes to shut down a mobile quarterback, kind of an option offense in that way, where it's going to be a lot of read option stuff that they're doing?
Yeah, they did great against Auburn. They're built for that kind of an offense.
Exactly.
They're smaller but faster players on defense.
Fast outside linebackers, too. They can get there. You run right at them, you can have some success. But when they go to the edges, you can absolutely get out there and stop them.
Right. And one thing that stood out to me is Vanderbilt's offensive line was last in the SEC in terms of, like, their weight. These guys average, like, 290. And coming off Georgia game where those guys are, like, 340 or something stupid, like, I think that's going to be a big difference for Florida, especially for kind of the undersized tackles, like a guy like Dominique Easley who did nothing against Georgia. Maybe he'll kind of get back into the swing of things here. Do you guys see that making a big difference? I think that's going to be huge in this game. Just that overall weight difference from what they've been facing to what Vanderbilt is.
I think Easley makes a lot of sense as a guy who will have a huge impact. With that quick first step against guys that are a little bit lighter too, he should be able to get off the ball a lot quicker than guys that they faced pretty much all season and then kind of get thrown around a little bit by him as well. So I think he's a guy that's benefited by that smaller offensive line quite a bit. And honestly, the whole Florida defensive line really is. This is a game they should dominate. And again, I feel like we've said that a couple times this year. They really haven't. But this is one I feel like they should probably take in hand as a defensive line.
I don't know why we're taking shots at Dominique.
I don't have anything against Dominique. He just had a bad game last week.
Sounds
that's
like
all
he,
that is.
You do have something against him.
He had a bad game last week. That's
probably
all I'm saying.
Probably the best player on the defensive line this season.
That's you could argue that.
Yeah,
you could also you can make a case for Jay Howard and Sharif Floyd, but I'd probably
you
agree
Dominique
with you.
Out of this.
Well, I mean, Dominique's perfect, but aside from that, do you think the defensive line's going to have a better, easier time against the lighter offensive line?
Yeah, Dominique's perfect. I think they'll be fine. I think this is going to be really fun for them.
All right.
It's a small little offensive lineman.
The other half of Vanderbilt's running game is X Stacy. He's looked pretty good so far, and I guess the difference between guys that Florida's faced, guys in the mold of like the Richardson and the Ware and the Dyers, those players have been successful. And then some of the other guys they faced early in the year who just weren't on that level struggled. So which group does X Stacy fall into? Is he one of those kind of elite backs that can give Florida trouble, or is he just a guy?
I don't really think he's in the elite category at all. The thing about this whole Vanderbilt offense that kind of confuses me is it's like the same guys from last year when they were just absolutely horrible. So I think the thread there is that James Franklin might be a really good offensive mind and has done some good things there, but Stacy really wasn't that good last year when Florida played him. He was kind of up and down a little bit. Really didn't break any long runs. I think Vandy got on the board with a last-second touchdown, and they're already down 40 or 50. So I think he's going to be kind of interesting to watch, but I don't think he's a huge threat to this defense. Now, unless he's this breakout guy this year, I don't think that, at least. I think he's your typical Vanderbilt running back who can run through some open holes, but he's not a guy that will run away from you. Sorry. So I don't know. I don't think he's that guy that is all that great, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I agree with what Cody said.
Yeah, I'm kind of on board with that, too.
Good job, Tyler.
In general, when I look at this matchup, I feel like this Vanderbilt team is not more talented than, like, the Tennessees and the Kentuckys that Florida just blew out. And that when you have such a gap in athleticism from what Florida's going to bring to what Vanderbilt's going to bring, that makes a much more noticeable difference. Even if Florida's not good at football, which we can kind of establish, like, Vanderbilt could be the more fundamentally sound team or anything like that, but I think just based on sheer athleticism, Florida has a chance to be as dominant as they were in the first few games. Am I just underestimating Vanderbilt here? Or?
I kind of agree with you on paper, but I don't know. Vanderbilt's played a lot better than their talent in recent weeks. I think
because of the fact that Vanderbilt has been so sound and they've been able to keep it tight with some good teams the last couple of weeks, or something that they had no business keeping it close with, this could be a potential upset. If you can even call it that, do we call that an upset?
I mean, Florida's a 14-point favorite, so you'd have to call it an upset.
True. Okay, that's true. That's because people are stupid.
I don't know. I'm on. We'll
You're
talk.
On board, we'll, 14-point favorite?
We'll give our predictions later, and we can get more into that. But do you guys buy that this is a new Vanderbilt, that James Franklin's made this much of a difference in 1 year? Because that's kind of been all the talk this week, is that this is not the same Vanderbilt team they've beaten 20 times in a row or whatever the streak's at this point, and that there is a new-look unit, new offense, more aggressive, all this stuff. Do you buy that? Do you see the same things they see?
Of course every coach is going to say that. It's impossible to tell at this point. It's too early to say whether this is a new team or not because they've come close to winning some games. Give them a couple off seasons to go through the program with the team, see how they do, recruit some players. Look at judge this in 3 years, not right now, kind of like the Muschamp thing we talked about earlier. Having said that, I think this game could be a potential win for Vanderbilt, like an upset, if you want to call it that, because of the fact that I'm not sure that Florida can do anything offensively. They got to run the ball, and that's it. Like, there's still that connection going on in the passing game that requires a ball going from point A to point B with perfect timing, with the ball being thrown correctly, with a good pass protection, things like that. And I just don't necessarily know if Florida's going to be able to do all of those little elements together. As a result, I think the offense is still going to clunk through another bad game, and that's why this game could be tight, and at the end, you just don't know.
Right. I realize it is early in Franklin's career, but there are a lot of positive signs for him right now. This really is the same Vanderbilt team from last year, from an offensive standpoint at least. They benched Larry Smith in favor of Rodgers. So they're kind of the same type of player, though. It's still Stacy. I think they might have actually gotten a little bit worse at the receiver position from last year. This offense is actually having quite a bit of success this year. So I think that's a huge positive for Franklin. There's a lot of stuff in his corner right now. It's working on the recruiting trail, too. They're going out and getting some guys that they shouldn't have gotten in the past, and we'll see if they can hold on to him. But he's actually doing a really good job for that program. And I don't know. I'm not all on the James Franklin bandwagon just yet, but there certainly are a lot of positive things in his corner right now.
Right. He certainly changed the mood, if nothing else. Just the way people think about Vanderbilt and what the team name Vanderbilt kind of brings to your mind is not the same kind of stuff it brought last year and in previous years. One last thing I want to make a note of is that Vanderbilt is, for what it's worth, they're 0-2 on the road this year. They've had a lot of their success at home. How much of a factor do you think Florida's crowd is going to be? Because even last week against Georgia in a split stadium, some of these guys are talking about how it was too loud and that was why they were having penalty problems. Do you think getting back home makes a big difference for them? Do you see that from either affecting Vanderbilt negatively or affecting Florida positively? Anybody have a take on that?
I think it's kind of a wash, just kind of from what we've learned about this game in recent years. Like, coming off losses, like I remember in 07 when Georgia beat Florida and then they came back here and played, I think, Vandy here in Gainesville the week after, seems kind of dead. So I think that's kind of up in the air tomorrow. We don't even know how many people are going to be there, first of all, but I feel like the stadium will be a little bit dead. And do you know where Vandy's their two losses were at?
They were at Alabama and lost 34-0, and they were at South Carolina and lost 21-3. So I know those are good teams, and those are fine teams to lose to, but they weren't competitive in those games either.
And 3 points on the road, too, in two games isn't a whole lot to talk about. So I feel like in the end this might turn into a typical Florida-Vandy game, but I could see it staying close for the first half.
Well, the Florida-Vandy games, it's hard to judge that because there have been some really close games
that's
Florida
true,
and Vanderbilt. I mean, in 06, when Florida won the national championship, they only beat Vanderbilt by 7. In 05, the year before that,
they beat Vanderbilt in double overtime.
Jay Cutler.
That was when Jay Cutler was quarterback at Vanderbilt. There have been some games that have been pretty tight for Florida and Vanderbilt, so I don't necessarily know how this is going to go. I think Vanderbilt's traditionally played Florida pretty well. As far as the crowd's concerned, I would say this is a 12:30 game. I don't see the Swamp being live as it is at an 8 o'clock.
But it's game. Homecoming.
That's that doesn't not matter. Really matter. That just means people are going to be more hungover.
Alright, that's fair. One thing before we kind of move on from that, our colleague Tom Green, and Monday guest on the podcast, wrote a column today about how in Zook's first year they played Vanderbilt very close, and then in Meyer's first year that was a that was the double overtime game Tyler talked about. So something to keep an eye on from that point, where for whatever reason, by sheer coincidence, most likely Vanderbilt's done good against Florida against first year coaches. So we don't really need to go position by position breakdown, but there's a couple guys I want to talk about. One that jumped out to me last week is Cody's boy Jordan Reed. Made an impact. Are you back on the bandwagon? You believe?
No, he's burned me too many times. I'm all out.
Tyler, do you have a take on Jordan Reed? Is he good now, or
no?
Just one good game.
I disagree with CBS announcer Gary Danielson, who compared Jordan Reed to Aaron Hernandez.
Said he's going to have a great pro career.
I'd say he's nothing like Aaron Hernandez. They're different kind of players altogether.
Like, yeah, Jordan. Jordan Reed wishes he was like Aaron Hernandez. Like, I think he's trying to be that, but he's just not as good.
But Hernandez is more of like an H-back. Like, they ran the option with him and stuff like that. Reed's more of like a stretch the field vertically type guy.
It's because Reed's not getting enough shovel passes.
Yeah, also true. If only.
Yeah, I don't even know if he had that good of a game though. Like, he got open on that fourth down and he beat one guy. It was man to man and he got a touchdown. You take that out, it's kind of just a disappointing game again.
Yeah, I think he had a good amount of catches. He led the team in yards. He was the only receiver that seemed to be a consistent threat, which isn't that unfamiliar.
I might just be jaded. I think that's what it is.
Right. You guys think this is the week we finally see Mike Gillisley? Any chance?
No.
No, I don't know. I don't think so.
He's still air quotes hurt. We don't really know what's going on with him.
I've given up on that stuff. Talk about it all the time. I don't feel like we'll ever see him. All
right, and then on the defensive side in the secondary, there was a little bit of a switch last week where Jalen Watkins started over Cody Riggs. Did you guys see anything from Watkins that you liked? Do you have a take on that situation or where it's going to go from here?
The only thing I really remember from Watkins is he got that controversial pass interference call on the third and long, and that ended up leading to a Georgia score later on the drive. But other than that, I didn't really see much from him. We asked Dan Quinn about it on Wednesday, and Dan said that was really just a factor of him. He practiced better than Cody that week. It wasn't necessarily that Cody had problems or that Jalen had all of a sudden become great. It was just on a week-to-week basis, Jalen was just better than Cody.
You believe that? Is that how they work it? Because I always felt like once you have set starters, another guy has to be significantly better, and the guy who's starting has to be a little bit worse, at least a little bit worse. Like, I think if you play at a consistent level, you're probably going to keep your job.
I know, obviously, Jalen's played better than Cody. That's
right, but
saying.
I think it has to be not just better, but like way better. That it stands out to the point that you feel you have to make that change.
I don't know, because they're all young and none of them really establish themselves as starters. You know what I mean?
That's fair.
That's true too. I know
one thing that was interesting though is you did have Pop Saunders playing nickel, and you had Josh Evans playing safety, and we didn't get to that in the interview. But that was another thing I think that was worth looking at.
Do you have a take on where they should be going with that? Actually, Cody, do you have anything on Watkins? I think you were going to say something.
I know Riggs is a little undersized. I think I'd go with him over Watkins, though. Watkins, actually, I thought got burnt quite a few times against Georgia.
One of the fourth down touchdowns was against him, right?
Morris King, I believe.
That's right. The fade.
Yeah.
He was there.
They just didn't make a play on the ball, and that's going to happen.
A third and 12, third and 13, third and long or something. I believe it might have been the beginning of that drive where he was playing so far off the receiver. And he just kind of turned his hips right at when the guy came off the line and started running like he was going to cover like a fly route or something like that. And the guy ran a quick out for 13 yards, got it as easily as possible, stepped out of bounds for the first down. I just feel like he seemed really passive in the game. I don't know. I've always been a bigger fan of Riggs. I realize he's undersized, but he's aggressive. He's not afraid to hit people. I don't know. I'm a little biased to him, I guess. But I think I would go back with him, especially after seeing Watkins. I felt like Watkins actually struggled quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't think either one has stood out, but I definitely agree that Watkins did not have a great game. And I guess when you're it's the same thing we talked about where they don't have depth, so they can't really push each other. If you think that in the secondary you have that, then let those guys push each other and make those switches as the games go along. And then you just touched on real quickly, Evans and Saunders. I mean, do you guys have a take on that situation? Because I think Josh Evans has been really bad.
Right, that's what I was going to say. Is any sort of defensive scheme that keeps Josh Evans off the field is probably the scheme you want to go with.
Right.
To me.
I mean, I feel like as a safety, it's pretty difficult to stand out as blatantly in a negative way as he did. Like, it's approaching Will Hill territory almost in terms of, like, how often he seems to be either out of position or missing a tackle or taking a bad angle or things of that nature.
Yeah, it's one of those things where if the running back gets the second level, Josh Evans wants nothing to do with them.
All right, and we've talked a little bit about like playing the younger guys. Maybe that's what you do is go with Pop Saunders and throw him out there for the next couple weeks and see what you got out of him, regardless of the fact that Evans is most likely coming back this year unless he pulls a Will Hill and goes pro after his junior year.
Well, Saunders was playing that three, that other safety's position
right.
for a while.
That's what I'm saying.
Saunders and nickel, which I didn't really get. Well, maybe they did run nickel for most of the game, so maybe they knew that and thought Saunders was, well, they also might have thought Saunders was better against the run, so maybe they put him at nickel. He's close
probably
to
is.
Stretch. Yeah, that's the thing that I never really thought about in terms of who the nickelback is, but they seem to put a lot of emphasis on, like, one week they had Elam kind of playing a nickelback position just because they get their best run-stopping secondary player closer to the line, so... Right. That's something that they do schematically that I guess you could say it hasn't worked out that well for them, but that's something that they're going with for now.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Elam worked out really well for them against Auburn.
He's played well. I have nothing against Matt Elam, but they haven't exactly shut down other teams' running games. And I know against Auburn they did good on a yards per carry basis, but they still said that they expect better out of their run defense. So that's what I have to go by.
I got to say, I don't think the defense as a whole is much of a problem for Florida this year.
Right, compared to
the two blowouts, but those other two games are all on the offense.
Compared to the other stuff that's gone wrong with the team, yeah, I would agree with you there.
Their defense is like 22nd overall in scoring defense, and like in the top 15 and just overall like total defense.
Right, but wasn't it like top 10 last year? Do we kind of?
It was like 9 last year.
So that's a little jaded. You don't really buy that, do you?
Well, here's the thing. I think the defense is great against those first four games. But at the same time, I don't think the defense has been a problem in these close games. Like I said, the defense, I think, is fine. It's just the offense is terrible. The offense is like 96.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. All right, prediction time. Tyler, you want to start us off?
Prediction for the score?
Yeah.
I'm going to go 14-10 Florida.
14-10. Okay, so you don't see either team getting it going on offense. It's a real grind-out game.
As established by the stats I brought up earlier, this
well,
is
I mean, bad defense,
really weird.
Bad defense versus bad offense could go either way, you know?
Yeah.
But you see bad defense win now?
Bad defense always beats bad offense. Bad defense wins championships. In games between bad teams.
There you go. Cody, what do you got?
I don't remember what I said in the picks column, but I think I'm going to take Florida 27-10.
Huh. See, I'm going to go back to my thing. I think bad defense wins the Gator Bowl.
Bad defense wins the Gator Bowl.
That's what they say.
Wow.
Solid clarification there.
All right. Do you have anything special to add? What's a matchup you're looking for in the prediction that's going to, you know, lead to this 27-10 result you have for us?
I think it'll stay close in the first half, say a 10-7 Florida lead going into halftime, and then I think the athletes are on Florida's side, and maybe it'll end up like last year's Florida-Vanderbilt game where they kind of just take off and there's nothing Vandy can do about it. When you've got the athletes, I feel like in the end that's kind of what things come back to.
Yeah, I'm very much with you on that front. And this is the second week we've kind of had a very similar prediction because I have 31-10 Florida. I think that just from a skilled athlete standpoint, they're going to completely overwhelm Vanderbilt. I especially look at that Florida defensive line versus Vanderbilt offensive line matchup. And I think that, you know, maybe Florida's biggest weakness right now, and actually we should debate this because I don't – it's you could go a lot of ways. I think Florida's biggest weakness is the offensive line, and I think – like Vanderbilt's defensive front is not going to be able to exploit that as well as some of these other teams have been able to. So I think when you match up well with one of their weaknesses and they don't necessarily have what it takes to exploit your weaknesses and you're overall better, like that's a big thing. Plus the crowd maybe is a factor. I just think there's a lot of things working against Vanderbilt and Florida should be able to have a pretty comfortable win for a change. But yeah, worst unit on Florida. You guys have a take?
I'm split between offensive line and quarterback play. Because a lot of these problems, in my opinion, are because of the fact that they've had way too predictable of an offense. So the run, they had trouble creating a run game against LSU and Auburn because everybody knew that Florida couldn't throw the ball. Against Georgia, everybody knew they couldn't really run the ball. Defensive ends just kind of tee off. Linebackers, whatever they want to do, they just sort of tee off on the quarterback. Like that affects you. It makes your job more difficult. Not saying the offensive line's good. I'm just saying that perhaps quarterback play could play a factor. Now, the one difference to me, and this probably makes it lean toward the offensive line, is the Alabama game in the first half. When they did have a good passing game, they still ran for, like, -7 or -11, you know,
right,
or something along those lines. So, I guess it goes offensive line, but I also think quarterback play is a big factor.
I guess if you're evaluating it based on the whole season, you could call it a toss-up between those two, but I think right now, going forward, the quarterback situation is a little more settled, and I would be a lot more comfortable with that compared to the offensive line.
Yeah.
If Brantley's back to 100%.
If Brantley can go drop back. The fact that Brantley was in the shotgun, though, affected that team a lot. Like, I was very... I guess they kind of thought that the fact that Brantley could throw the ball decent, and they knew they'd have to kind of sacrifice the run game, was more important than having a balanced offense with another one of these experienced quarterbacks who, frankly, isn't that good right now. I don't know which one's better. That's really sort of a pick your poison. Neither one's going to really help your team that much.
For the sake of conversation, I'm going to go with a third unit, the wide receivers.
Really?
Oh, that's a sleepy pick. I didn't think about that.
No, they're not good.
I wouldn't put money on this, but I just feel like they are bad enough and haven't got mentioned so far.
Well, here's the thing. I think that's a good point because when they suck, it's like they just sit out there and you don't really notice how bad they are. But when the offensive line is bad, you see it on every play.
It's true. Yeah.
So I think there's a good chance that you're right on that, and it just hasn't stood out to such a great extent.
It's amazing. There's really only two receivers that coaching staff trusts, and it's Frankie Hammond and Andre DeBose, and after that, it's nobody.
But see, I'm confused by even that because those guys aren't on the field enough. I agree, if those are the guys they trust,
like they should just be out there more. I would think.
Like DeBose, the ones who they actually like.
What did DeBose have a catch? One catch was a third down. It was a pretty nice route and everything. But then he was out there maybe 50, 60% of the time the rest of the game. Right. I just don't really understand the receiver rotations there, especially when you've got pretty much zero explosive guys on the team at that position.
And then I guess that kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, where if you have the depth, they can push each other, but if they all suck, it doesn't make a difference.
Exactly. And I think that's what this is.
They had a bunch of lottery tickets there, and none of them panned out to this point. So
you have a lot of the same guys out there. That's it.
All right, now I'll move over to the host seat here, and I'll start asking you guys some questions about the Florida basketball game from last night, which would be Thursday night for the listeners at home. I don't know when y'all are hearing this. This is a podcast for Friday. But I didn't get to see the game. You guys did. Only two things I really want to touch on because of the fact that this is Catholic University and an exhibition game. You can't really learn a whole lot about...
Either way.
Whichever one you want to learn about, you can't get much of it.
Or a lot of it.
From this game. But I guess the first thing would be some of these new faces, guys we've heard a lot about in the last year and a half, really. Brad Beal and Mike Rosario. Again, don't get to see much from them since it's Catholic University, but you did actually get to see them play in front of your own eyes. So what are your impressions of those guys?
They're really good. I mean, Brad Beal, we've heard about him for a couple of years since he's been committed to Florida, always been one of the top players in the country. As good as I expected him to be, I really think he was a little bit better. He is so smooth. It was really impressive to watch him, too, because he got his three-point shot going in the first half. Defense started to stretch out to him a little bit. He used pump fake, went around people in the second half, got right to the basket. And basically, he could have probably scored 30 or 40 if he wanted. Ended with 20. Was going to be the leading scorer until Kenny Boynton hit a three with, I believe, less than a minute to go in the game. So
had to sneak in there.
Yeah, it was really, really rude of him. But
exhibition game savant Kenny Boynton, by the way. He scores like 20 every time it's a preseason exhibition.
That is a good point. So he'll be gone next Friday. But Mike Rosario, too, kind of the same thing. Really smooth, I thought. It was really impressive to see. He just kind of glides around the court. He's got a really good sense to him, and he seems like a really smart passer as well. Had a couple really nice passes on fast break to set up a dunk for Patrick Young and then a dunk for Beal, actually, as well. So really impressed with those guys. I guess as impressed as you can be after an exhibition game.
Right, and I agree with you on Beal. He was great. And then the first couple of minutes, I wasn't sure he was really in the flow of the offense, and he hasn't played with them in a game before, so that was natural. And he took a couple of long-range threes where it wasn't, in rhythm. It was just kind of throwing it up there. But after, 3 minutes, it was like he was there and he had it under control. And he was getting open shots and he was finding teammates. And it was like Billy Donovan said, they took 40 threes in the game and hit 20 of them. And he said, he doesn't know if they took a bad three in the first half. And I think maybe Beal had one or two. But other than that, once they kind of got into their rhythm, it was a lot of open shots. And that's why they were able to knock them down. And then in the second half, he just started, doing everything else that he can do. He was driving past people, and he was just overall making plays, and he looked as good as advertised. And then the same thing with Rosario, where, he came off the bench, so it took him a couple extra minutes to kind of get it going. But once he kind of got into the flow of the offense, he looked really good as well.
Absolutely. I think the thing that impressed me the most with Beal is he had zero turnovers. He had five assists, no turnovers. For a freshman in his first collegiate game to do that, and not only to have zero turnovers, but to look as good as he did and in the flow of it and the rhythm of everything going on, I just was extremely impressed with him. I don't think there's anything he could have done to impress me more. He really scored in every way. He had the three-point shot going, his mid-range jumper, and he got to the basket as well.
Right, and then it's the same thing with Rosario. The first time he got the ball, Billy Donovan Jr. came in and took it from him. Right. And then from that point on, six assists, no turnovers for him. So, they needed a minute to get it going, but they definitely looked good.
How are they using both of those guys?
Beal was at the three when he started. He's kind of he's one of their longer players, and they're going to use him that way. Especially he's 6'4". He looks every inch of it too. He really does. He's a big guy.
Okay,
he's built too. He's pretty thick for a freshman just out of high school. So you think he might add a little bit of weight in the next year and see what happens then.
And then Rosario's got a chance to play. He's kind of shorter than I thought he was. He's probably going to be mostly a two guard for them because he doesn't have, at least in his career, he hasn't shown the ability to be much of a point guard. And I know last night the two primary point guards were Walker and Boynton, and that's got to do with the fact that Wilbekin was out probably more than anything else. But, it looks like Rosario will be at the two, and Beal they have some flexibility with.
Now, the big storyline going into the season is the fact that they're so deep in the backcourt and not very deep in the frontcourt. How are they running the offense with so many guards and really a pretty thin group of big men?
I think it's kind of hard to make an opinion on that last night just because when the three started falling the first half, they basically forgot about the guys inside. And for good reason, when you're shooting that hot, I mean, why would you? But they came out in the second half. That's something that Beal actually told us after the game that Coach Donovan made a point at halftime was that they were going to start stepping out and covering the three, so Florida needed to go inside a little bit more. They did that at the beginning. I really like Eric Murphy's game around the basket. I know a lot of people have kind of said he's soft, and he probably is, but he's very creative around the basket. He's got an extremely efficient offensive game, I feel like. He had a quiet 17 points last night.
Yeah, he does. And I think that if they're going to play fast, he's a great big guy for that in terms of being able to kind of trail the play and then hit the three behind the defense where they're kind of all kind of collapsing down as UF attacks in transition. Then he's just out there at the three-point line, and he's a great shooter. I mean, as good as Beal and Rosario are, he could hit as high a percentage as those guys because he's not going to take as many and he's not going to look as pretty doing it, but he gets it done out there. And, I mean, I don't know how well he fits because, like I said, I joked to you last night. I got to sit next to Cody at the game. It was awesome.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I joked last night that sometimes it looks like he's playing in slow motion, and I don't know what that is. And against Catholic, that's fine, but I don't know if he's the athlete to match up with Terrence Jones.
That's a good point.
So,
no,
he's not really excited when you said Terrence Jones.
Terrence Jones is the man.
You could stop smiling there.
I love basketball. It's just a great time for me.
My only issue with this team, and it's not like I'm breaking news here or anything like that, but it's the rebounding thing, and I think it flared itself up a little bit last night. For whatever reason, I still can't figure this out. Patrick Young is not a good rebounder.
Yeah, it's hard to judge because he didn't play a ton last year, and this was Catholic, and I don't know what's going on with that, but he's not dominant on the boards, per se.
He's got the Dwight Howard-esque physique, and, he's really aggressive, too. That's the thing, is like he'll hustle all over, he's diving all over the floor. He should be a good rebounder, but for whatever reason, he just doesn't have a nose for the ball. I think part of it kind of shows on the defensive end. He leaves his feet quite a bit still. I think he maybe leaves his feet a little early for rebounds as well and gets kind of hung up in the air. But he definitely, I think, has some room to grow if they're going to rebound a lot. Because I think he had 7 last night, but it was only 3 in the first half. And he really didn't, I don't think, made it his impact felt like he should have in a game against Catholic.
Do you think that's a discipline issue or is that a court awareness issue?
I think it's more court awareness than anything, to be honest with you. Because he sometimes, I don't know if he gets caught watching guards or something like that, but it just seems like he's always out of position a little bit. He needs to get a little bit better boxing out, but I don't feel like that's a huge issue for him. I think he's been fine doing that, but he just can't ever be around the ball, and it's so weird for a guy that's always hustling and diving all over the court to not make that happen.
I think there's a lot of guys in basketball where when the shot goes up, they kind of know where the rebound's going to come out. Like Kevin Love's a great example. He's not a great athlete, but when the shot goes up, he knows where the rebound's going to come and he can get in position and grab it. Patrick Young is a great athlete, but he doesn't seem to have that where like he just knows where the ball's coming off because he's in his spot and the ball's coming off to the other side and somebody else is crashing in to get it.
Exactly. I think that's where that court awareness comes in.
So Patrick Young's like the bizarro Kevin Love, a really athletic-looking black man instead of a really unathletic-looking white man.
And he can't shoot. Yeah, it's a pretty good opposite comparison.
Can we just call him bizarro Kevin Love for the rest of the year?
It works for me.
Let's get it.
But yeah, one more thing I want to touch on is I think they can kind of overcome the rebounding thing, even if that's going to be an issue, because I know it was against Catholic last night, but the press looked okay, and they're going to have to improve because to hang against Ohio State. But they had 16 steals. That doesn't happen very often in a game. And, it was Catholic. But it just the ability to kind of have the awareness and be out there in the press and, you know, attack people that way, I think you can overcome a lot of the rebounding struggles sometimes
and
with
the,
that.
The rebounding is important, and that's something I didn't even think about last night. Billy Donovan said is that the rebounding is important, obviously, just for the sake of rebounding itself, but also because this team is so good in transition, they have to be able to rebound and get out on a fast break because that's really where all those guards will be able to score.
All right, one last thing on predictions, a different kind of predictions before we move into Gator Guarantee. I want you guys to kind of rank the possible finishes to Florida's season by how likely you think they are in terms of what their record's going to be the rest of the way. So, like, mine would be, I think it's most likely they go 2-2. If not that, then I think it's most likely they go 1-3. And then after that would be 3-1, 4-0, and then 0-4 at the end, because I just don't think they can lose to Furman. But other than that, I feel like a lot of these could go either way, and that's why I kind of settle out with 2-2 at the top. And then I think it's more likely that they lose all three other than Furman than it is that they win all three other than Furman, because...
Well, yeah.
Like, South Carolina and Florida State, those are just tough teams, basically.
I think it is more likely that they would be, that they would lose to Vanderbilt, Florida State, and South Carolina, and then beat Furman, than beat South Carolina, Vanderbilt, and Florida State, and then lose to Furman.
Oh, no, but I meant...
Maybe you said that.
Oh, yeah, that's not what I meant. But yeah, that's fair. Yeah, that's highly, highly, highly unlikely. So, yeah, do you guys kind of agree with where my head is on that, or you guys have your own kind of ranking system for how you think this is going to work out?
I'm going to start with 2-2. I feel like that's most likely. I feel like 3-1 is the second most likely.
Really?
And I have no reason to believe that other than I'm pretty confident they're going to beat Vandy and
Furman.
So okay. I feel like...
So then they just have to split the last two.
Yeah, they would be more likely to split those two.
Than to lose them both?
No. It would be more likely to lose them both because then they would be 2-2.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So then they would split them and go 3-1. And then I'll say 1-3 would be third.
Right.
And then 4-0.
And then 0-4 because they're just not going to lose to Furman.
Right.
I'm going to agree with Cody's logic on that one, actually. I was originally thinking 1-3, but you made a good point. They're probably going to beat Vanderbilt, and they're probably going to beat Furman. So that automatically gets you 2 wins, which means 3 wins is more likely than 1 win.
Right, that's fair. You guys have almost kind of flipped my mind on that, but I'm still stick with the way I had it. All right, so we're going to move into the Gator Guarantees now that we got that record prediction thing out of the way. Tyler, what do you got for us? And then recap last week's, too, as well.
This week, my prediction, or should I start with last week?
Start with last week.
To make it easier on the listeners. All right, last week I guaranteed that Aaron Murray would throw for 300 yards or more and at least 3 touchdowns. Not a great game out of him. Not a good game out of him. A below average game, I would say.
I'd call it bad.
I'd say below average.
It's debatable.
Well, here's why. He had 2 touchdowns, 0 interceptions, correct?
1 interception.
2 touchdowns, 1 interception.
Interception wasn't his fault, though.
Yeah, when it hit the guy in the helmet.
Yeah, I'm not holding that against him.
Okay, so 2-0. Okay.
We're calling that 2 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. However, he only completed 15 of 34 passes, which is atrocious.
Yikes.
Thanks for the sound effects. And he only ended up with 169 yards passing, I believe, which is just barely above halfway to 300, which is what I thought he would get. So, my bad, guys. I guess, I mean, you can kind of chalk that up with the Florida defensive backs. They played pretty well, I guess. I don't know.
Aside from the times they got mossed, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, you hold a guy 169 yards passing, and he comes in leading the SEC in passing yards per game, or second behind Tyler Bray.
I believe he missed a lot of open receivers.
Yeah, I'm going to put this on you. I think he just screwed up.
No.
There were guys that were open, and you really blew it.
No, this is not on me. This is on Aaron, okay? Take this up with Aaron. This week, my prediction is that Florida will turn the ball over 3 times. If I'm going to get a little bit more fancy, it's going to be 2 interceptions and a fumble. Vanderbilt, like we talked about earlier, very good at getting turnovers through the passing game. Not great at defending the pass, but they'll get some picks. So I think they get 2 interceptions. The fumble, I'm going to put this on Chris Rainey if he's playing.
All right.
Safe choice.
All right. So, yeah, three turnovers would be pretty bold for a Florida-Vanderbilt game. So I like that call. Cody, what do you have for us? And then recap last week. We had to go in the archives to pull this one out because he wasn't here last week.
Last week was the Auburn game for me. So
right.
I said, what did I say, 3 touchdowns for Kyle Frazier?
Yep.
He had 0.
Okay.
So
well, you were close.
Nailed it. And this week I'm going to go with...
You didn't nail it.
You're very right. I'm going to say 10 penalties for Florida at minimum. Really? I just think they're going to go crazy again.
That's fair. I mean, there's going to be a lot of crowd noise. It's going to be their crowd, but that doesn't matter.
That's a good
Everything
point.
Affects them.
Things are going to be pretty loud. So I'm going to say 10 penalties. I don't really know why.
That's a fine prediction. I think they averaged a nation-leading 9 so far this season. So they'd be one-upping themselves and certainly extending that lead a little bit. All right. I'm really disappointed about how my Gator Guarantee went last week. I kind of thought I had it. Mine was that John Brantley would throw for 250 yards. And in the first half, he threw for 226. So I was there. I was on the precipice. And then he threw for 19 yards in the second half.
Completed what, two passes?
It was like he knew. Yeah, two passes in the second half for 19 yards.
How many attempts did you
know? He was 2 for 14 in the second half for 19 yards.
I feel like the painkillers wore off about the third drive.
Take some more, bro.
You probably should have.
Just handle that.
For real. Once those wore off, though, he couldn't do anything.
Yeah, and I mean, I was ready to tweet that I was victorious and I was going to have a celebration and we were going to party, and it just didn't work out the way I thought it would. So
what does a John Brantley 250-yard passing party look like?
Kind of like this, but there's no microphone. We just kind
of hang out.
We just kind of hang out. Yeah, it would have been great. Trust me. All right, this week we're going to get on track. I have the Vanderbilt Rodgers is going to emulate brother Aaron. And he's going to score a touchdown, and he's going to be the little championship belt celebration.
The State Farm discount double check?
The discount double check, yeah. he may or may not say discount double check, but we'll get the championship belt, and that's all that really matters. All right, so that's the Gator Guarantees for this week. Moving into the email, we got one again from Marshall Spivak, who is our favorite emailer at this point.
He's our go-to guy this year.
We're a big fan.
He's my Gator Guarantee.
So he's got a couple points in here, but we'll just start off. He's got, what up with the Gators? If they are not going to use Gillislee or Brown and they are going to stick to those sweeps and swing passes, then how do we get the offense to move the ball? Well, if I were Weiss, I would look at the speed I have and start working in some misdirections, reverses, and other things to take advantage of the speed. There are other plays than to try to go around the edge. So do you guys, I mean, this is something that, I don't know, I hadn't thought about it, but it kind of makes sense that when your kind of defense, your offense is built on speed, that you would kind of try to get people flowing one way and then give it off to another one of the fast guys and they're going the other way and kind of generate misdirection like that. Do you know why we haven't seen any of that so far?
I don't know for sure. Maybe they're saving up for the Vanderbilt game. Maybe they'll start the game where they reverse and then they will switch it and go with a double reverse, and then they'll go to a reverse where they fake the double reverse but actually just go with a regular reverse, and then they'll do a double reverse that ends with a pass, and then they'll go back to the reverse. And then they do a reverse, 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 triple reverse.
This is bold.
And then they'll go over two reverses.
Touchdown.
That's three touchdown drives right there. That's the play calling for three touchdown drives. It's a new offense that Charlie Weiss has really been tinkering with, I bet. That's the decided schematic advantage he's been hyping up for years.
No, but on a serious note, do you think that that's something that could work for this offense? Doesn't that seem like when you have kind of speed and that's your big thing and you can't have a power game, that would be something you would want to try to do?
Yeah, I don't know what just happened, but I think it kind of makes sense from that standpoint to at least, like, try it. I mean, they haven't done it one time, and I feel like that's something that Urban Meyer used quite a bit in the past couple of years. Even when the offense wasn't going, they always, because they had these same type of players, the smaller guys that aren't going to run people over. But the defense can over pursue to one side when they throw a little sweep to Rainey. And I feel like they have it set up too. They've been running those little stretch plays and the toss plays to Rainey to get outside. I think Tyler's right. They've been setting it up all year for Vandy.
On a serious note, that I am surprised they haven't tried it one time. On the average, a team probably runs a reverse three times in a season. At least, I don't know.
At least. I mean, when you have the speedy receivers, you would think that those are kind of the guys you would want to get swinging around and get the ball in their hands that way, especially a guy like DeBose, if you can get him the ball in a reverse. I don't know. So that makes sense to us, but we'll see. We'll see if that happens at any point this year. And then he goes on, then start working Driscoll into the mix to get ready for 2012. Also, Rainey and Demps will be gone. So use them for the above and start mixing in your power game with players that are going to be on the team next year. And then it ends with ARG. So I don't know if he's a pirate or... Anyway.
Wow.
So how do you guys... I mean, in general, the concept of switching over to younger players and kind of getting them in the mix more so than just playing the guys you've been playing and doing what is... Like, even if you have to sacrifice a little bit in terms of you don't even think these are your best guys, but getting them out there because they're younger and get them some experience. Do you buy into that idea at all?
I'm okay with it. But I think bowl eligibility is the thing number one. So you have to, once that happens, then I think do whatever. The other thing is, I don't know if Driscoll is the go-to guy after that point.
I'm pretty sure it's Brissett.
Yeah, I think obviously they'd probably give both reps because they want it to be a battle throughout the spring and everything like that. They at least want to sell it as that. So I think that both guys would probably get playing time and might in the future. That Furman game, I think those guys will see quite a bit of playing time.
It's a bold prediction.
What is?
that they'll play a lot in the Furman game.
Can I count that as my Gator guarantee?
Save it.
Save it for 2 weeks from now.
Is that even bald? The backup quarterback's going to play a lot against the D2 team?
No, it's not. That was me being sarcastic.
Gosh, that was ridiculous.
He thought he had an easy one.
Needs to be doing is start practicing shagging fly balls.
I agree with that.
Center fielder with Florida Gators.
Outside of the quarterback situation, do you guys see other younger guys that you want to get in the mix? I know
it's a pretty young team.
We did kind of a rally here, and Tom wanted to see more of Juwan's story just because we haven't seen him in... Maybe he doesn't suck. I don't know.
I don't think that makes any sense at all at this point. You don't give up his redshirt at this point.
I agree completely.
Season.
All right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's no other receivers that haven't gotten in. Maybe you put like Tevin Westbrook at defensive tackle. I kind of like him a little bit. I think he'll be decent.
Why?
Because he's looked decent when he was in there, and he's huge.
Who?
Tevin Westbrook.
Are you serious right now?
When was he? I know who he is, but I don't remember him being in the game.
He got in Kentucky, and I remember watching him a couple of snaps. He's like 6'6", 290.
He looked
and here's
awesome.
My theory. He's a basketball player, too. And I like defensive linemen who are basketball players. They feel like they're explosive.
Yeah, and he thought he'd easily be a hell of a basketball player.
Exactly. That's my sleeper pick. When he's an All-American, just remember.
That's your Gator guarantee, folks. Keep that one in mind.
Is he All-American in the future?
All right, and then Marshall, there's a second part of Marshall's email, which goes on to the...
I thought you said it ended with an R.
That section ended with an R. It's broken into paragraphs.
Oh, that's how he signed off. Okay.
No, he signs off peace out, which is pretty cool. But
he's
also
a hit pirate.
Yeah, exactly. this is something I don't know if you guys listen to that show. It's probably not. But we one time he emailed in and asked about if it's time for Florida to change their uniforms because basically looking at schools like Oregon and that sort where it kind of helped recruiting and kind of got the program going. And he cited that the year they were 0-10, Florida was winless. They changed uniforms the next year and kind of started turning things around and that it's exciting to recruits. And Watts pretty much belittled him to the point where I'm surprised he even talks to us anymore.
Watts belittles him? I wouldn't believe that Watts would ever belittle somebody.
Right. That's very unlike him. But I think we kind of came to the consensus that has no bearing on anything and is a little bit ridiculous. But do you guys have a thought on if it matters to get new uniforms and if it's about time for Florida to do that?
Well, I think it's interesting. I don't know, there's a good article in Grantland on this and just kind of talking about Oregon's football program. And they kind of built themselves on these uniforms. And it's all about getting attention. Like, that's the era we're in now as a society, is what kind of things can you do to stand out for everybody else? Because everybody's got a lot of information. Everybody knows a lot about a lot of things because of the access we have to everything. We can watch a million football games now. But what are the little things you're going to do to stand out? And so from a program building perspective, I'm not going to, look down on the idea of changing uniforms. I don't think Florida needs to do that necessarily. But I got to say, I'm not a big fan of the orange uniforms. So don't do those anymore. I'll say that. But I don't think – my main point here is I don't think that uniform changing will – affect Florida. It would help you if you're a startup program trying to stand out.
I agree with that. I think there's a reason you have not seen the classic uniforms in college football ever be changed, like the Michigan and the USC, like
those beautiful uniforms that Penn State has.
Oh, absolutely, they're gorgeous.
Bama was one that came
out. Those look like the creative player uniforms on Madden.
Exactly. That's awesome. But I just feel like it's kind of classic, and it's what makes your program have tradition. I guess a little bit. I think tradition's a little overrated at some point, but. I don't know. I think that you'd kind of lose a lot if they did that. But they kind of have the what are they called? The pro combat uniforms they've used a couple times, like Georgia last year. So you still have that element to it a little bit. But I feel like if a recruit's going to my school because he wants to wear a uniform, I probably don't want that guy anyway. I feel like there's a lot of guys on this Florida team that would go to a school because of a uniform.
And that's the reason they shouldn't play at all.
Exactly.
That's really hurt Oregon, and LeGarrette Blount went there because he liked their uniforms.
Exactly.
That really hurt them.
Well,
once Darren Thomas. You just said that.
I mean, I'm saying, like...
I feel like the guys who go to work for uniforms.
He doesn't want the bad guys who only want to go for the
uniform.
I'm
saying that's a stupid reason to choose a school.
Okay, but sometimes kids are stupid, and stupid kids a lot of times end up being good football players.
See, that's the thing. He says that in here.
Here's the thing.
He says in here, it doesn't matter what we like. It's about what the recruits like.
Yeah,
and he also
that's
said, it also
point.
Says tradition is just a prison from the future.
I don't know what that means. But
my head just exploded, and I'm not even mad.
It's going to be the new tagline for the Independent Florida Alligators, Alligator Sports Podcast. I will say this, though, from what Cody said, the uniform change thing, that's all about brand building and making yourself a brand that people want to buy into. Florida, Texas, USC, a lot of these other schools, Penn State, whatever, they're already brands. Ohio State, you name it. These traditional schools, they're already brands. They're the Cokes. They're the McDonald's. People already know about them. They just got to keep doing what they do. However, some of these other places, these Oregons, apparently Maryland, these schools that are looking to become, these schools that are looking to become enticing for recruits long term, these schools that honestly want to get on that level, they've got to change the game up. You can't play by the same rules. You've got to find different ways to play. I know that Greg actually on Facebook linked to a Malcolm Gladwell article on underdogs.
Yeah.
I read that a couple years ago. It's a really good article, but the point that he was making is that if you're an underdog in any sort of game, whatever it is, and I don't just mean game, I mean just in life, whatever, whether it's your business, whether it's, you know, your army, whatever, if you're an underdog, if you have less chances of winning because your forces just aren't as good, you've got to play the game by a different rule.
Until the system changes its rules to beat you, but that's a whole other
thing. Yeah. But so Oregon played their game by a different rule, by becoming flashy. Some of those uniforms are ugly, but every game it's a different uniform, and every game we're kind of talking about it a little bit. So maybe it's not the uniforms, maybe it's something else, but you've got to find some way to stand out if you're a startup program.
And okay, one thing on standing out, he points out that Florida's the only Gators, and they should be able to do something cool with that, just because they're the only team that's... Like, if you're the Cardinals or something, you can't really do something that different from what everybody else is doing, but if you're the Gators, you should be able to do cool things.
I've been
things.
Pushing for them to put a live Gator on the field for a long time.
That would be so cool.
I think they used to.
They should do that.
I think in the 60s or 70s.
Like, the
issue with jerseys, though, is sometimes you can get too cute with them. Like, we were talking about the basketball jerseys last night.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up.
Like, they look kind of ridiculous on the back, I think.
It's basically...
There's a lot of people disagree with me on that.
It basically says Gators on the front in, like, kind of smallish, really weird font, and it's, like, a white jersey. And on the back, it kind of has, like, an alligator back print.
I found out what it is.
Oh, okay. Break it down for me.
There is, on the top of the back is, like, alligator skin. I don't exactly know what the design is, but that's the reason. And on the bottom, we were trying to figure out what it was.
With
it's
the
two
stars.
National championship trophies.
So, like, so the alligator's carrying around the trophies on his back.
I don't know. We're going to have to look again closer. But I know that there's, like, something with alligator skin. I'm assuming an alligator. And then two national championship trophies below it. But it's kind of like, I know Duke does it too. They have like that same little design on the back of the jerseys before, like around the numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
I just don't really, I feel like that's like just trying to get too cute with stuff.
Right,
like,
so basically new jerseys are cool, but you can't be trying too hard.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
That and also, it doesn't have to necessarily be jerseys. You got to find something to stand out, because 18-year-old kids don't care that Notre Dame was good at football 20 years ago.
But do you, as Florida, though? Like,
I think
you're already that brand.
You're a brand, and you can use that, and that's fine. But I'm not necessarily saying that you apply this to Florida as much as you would apply to some other schools. But because Florida has been a brand the last 5 years, they've won national championships recently. That's the difference between Florida and Notre Dame. That's why I was bringing up the Notre Dame example. But I mean, I'm not against, even if you are already the brand, you can still do things to change it up. Like, I don't know if you've read any of that ESPN book, but they kind of talk about how they're constantly changing things. Like, they started a magazine just because they could. They tried this thing called ESPN The Phone or whatever, and it failed, but they were willing to try that, and that eventually influenced smartphones down the road. You know what I mean? Like, you don't just... You always got to keep trying to do different things, no matter what brand you are, no matter what business you are.
Eventually, though, in college football, the one thing that you have to do is just win.
Well, yeah.
Like, just win people.
Obviously, that's the end game. Everything you're doing is to try to help you win.
But when you win, that helps recruiting in itself.
Well, yeah.
Right.
How do you get to that point?
Jerseys help winning, and winning helps recruiting, and recruiting helps winning.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily jerseys. Just different. There's a lot of different elements that help winning that you may not necessarily think are the traditional elements that would influence winning.
If only you guys were here when we read this email the first time. It would have been so much nicer.
Yeah.
Oh,
well, maybe you'll listen to it again.
Oh, well. Anyway, I guess that about wraps it up for this week. It's a monster edition
it's
we have
so
on
hot.
Our hands right now with the basketball and the general overview and Vanderbilt. That's a lot of stuff to talk about. Yeah, we've touched on a lot of different things today. So
what an important podcast.
Right. So I guess we'll get out of here. You can follow us on Twitter at Alligator Sports. You can follow me at Greg Luca. You can follow Tyler
at Tyler _Jet. We've gone through this.
Yep, we're not gonna talk anymore about that.
That's a good point.
And you can follow Cody. He changed it up. He wasn't happy with the old Twitter handle. He took a couple weeks off from the show to kind of
adapted his brand.
And now he's coming back fresh with Florida.scout.com, which is Fighting Gators.
Fighting Gators with one G in the middle. And I'm on Twitter at CJonesScout. So
right.
We were part of the Scout Network. So, yeah, it's always interesting.
So, yeah, I mean, just talk more about what's going on with that. Like, again, like I say, you sat here for an hour and 15 minutes
That's
now.
A good point.
You can talk a little bit about Scout.
Well, we kind of cover everything, football, basketball, baseball, the whole message
board
angle.
Baseball.
Yeah, that's kind of my child is Florida baseball that I enjoy covering. So there's a whole bunch of that. Message board angle, people obviously like that kind of stuff. And then recruiting is still kind of the lifeblood of the site. That's kind of what people pay for, is that whole aspect of it. So a lot of stuff doing that, a lot of recruiting, a lot of football, moving into basketball season obviously as well, and baseball is right around the corner.
All right. Well, I guess you can also follow us on Facebook. You can like us at facebook.com/alligatorpodcast. Be sure to send any feedback to podcast.alligator.org. Also subscribe on iTunes. As far as future shows, I'm sure we'll be back on Monday with a recap show, and then we'll have to do something to preview South Carolina. Maybe it'll be a Thursday show because of the fact that there's going to be travel involved. One thing, actually, if you guys can, any listener feedback you guys want to give me on this, sometimes I feel like right now we're sitting here, it's Friday around 1:15, and the game's in like 23 hours. I'm not sure how many people get to listen to the show before the game actually starts, and it's a game preview. So if you guys are having an issue with that, we can try to find a way to get it out Thursday. But just let me know how this kind of fits into your schedule and what you're looking for out of the podcast. So be sure to hit us up on there, and we will see you Monday. Until then, thank you for listening. Lean grind.